The mood music of ISIS today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. One of the London attackers has been identified as Khurram Butt, and he didn't hide his extremist connections.
He was part of a group that was in fact called Al-Muhajirun. This is a banned organization in the United Kingdom. I've heard it described as the mood music of the Islamic State.
Plus, former National Security Advisor Susan Rice says Trump's America First policy neglects one important reality. At some point, we're going to need help.
We need partners, and they don't want to work with us because we have told them that their security is something secondary to us. Then we shouldn't be surprised, frankly, if they're less interested in coming when we call.
Those stories, plus the steamy delights of Hong Kong dumplings, all today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. One was known to British police, another to Italian authorities, and yet the three young men went undetected as they planned Saturday night's London Bridge attack. All three were shot dead by police, you'll recall, within minutes of launching their killing spree. And now British investigators have revealed their identities. 22-year-old Yusuf Zagba, Khurram Butt, 27, and Rashid Ridwan, age 30. We're going to spend the next few minutes exploring what we now know about them, starting with the New York Times' Rukmini Kalamaki, who says the three attackers had very different backgrounds.
Khurram Butt was a Pakistani immigrant. He was flagged as an extremist as far back as 7 years ago. We've now collected testimonies from at least four people who in different capacities called authorities to say that he was trying to lure their children to extreme Islam or exhibiting behavior that indicated a radical faith.
And Mr. Butt had been part of this thing called the London Underground. Can you clarify what all that is about?
Yes, he was part of a group that was in fact called Al-Muhajirun. This is a banned organization in the United Kingdom that is run by a jailed radical cleric named Anjum Chowdhury. I've heard it described as the mood music of the Islamic State, setting the tone. This is an organization that preaches an extreme version of Islam. The guy who ran it, Anjum Chowdhury, who's now in jail, was actually a trained lawyer. And so he was incredibly clever and deft at managing to just walk up to the edges of the line of free speech without crossing it until very recently. And according to analysts that I've spoken to, at least half, if not more than half, of all of the terror attacks committed in the United Kingdom since 2005 have some sort of link to Al-Muhajirun. This is one of the acute problems that the United Kingdom is facing and that Prime Minister Theresa May tried to address in a speech this weekend, which is that because of the country's free speech provisions, it's been very hard to harness this group run by a lawyer who knew exactly what kind of things to say without crossing into something that would be prosecutable.
Briefly, Rukmini, the other two suspects who were killed, Rashid Ridwan and Yusuf Zagba, are they also connected to this larger network? Or
Yusuf Zagba, I just learned from one of my sources, did have a contact with an Al-Muhajirun member in Italy. Rashid Ridwan is the one who's sort of the gray man in all of this. We know very little about him.
So these assailants were shot and killed 8 minutes after the police were first notified. On one hand, the cops got their guys in super short order. On the other, officials are getting heat because one of the men was visible, known to cops, and even appeared in a TV documentary, The Jihadis Next Door. What are the cops dealing with right now?
What the police are telling us is that they have 500 people that are actively under investigation right now. 500 is a lot of people. I mean, when you say active investigation, that implies that these people are being watched 24/7. And it's been explained to me that in order to watch somebody 24/7, you need to deploy between 20 and 25 people to be able to do that. So imagine 20 times 500, how many people are being used.
Right, that's per suspect.
Per suspect, yeah. And as you pointed out, it took just eight minutes of inattention, right, for these people to go ahead and do this. Beyond those 500, we're being told that there are 3,000 people on a list of radicalized individuals that are also of concern. And beyond the 3,000, we're being told that there's an extra 20,000 who are people that are in contact with those 3,000. The numbers are unmanageable, and we're seeing this in every European country. Authorities are just struggling with how to contain this.
So, I mean, I can see how this is a really tough job. Are the police getting blamed for not being able to plug all the holes? I mean, it sounds like they don't have the resources.
There's a lot of hand-wringing in the United Kingdom right now. There's a lot of finger-pointing. You know, politicians, much like our own, are making hay of this and saying that, you know, that the current administration took their eye off the ball. But the reality is, the United Kingdom has actually done pretty well up until now. While France was being pummeled with back-to-back terror attacks, including really the worst attack on European soil in over a decade in November of 2015, the United Kingdom had numerous foiled plots, but they were just that, they were foiled. Mm. Up until March of this year, the United Kingdom had not had a successful ISIS attack.
The New York Times, Rukmini Kalamaki there in London. As I mentioned earlier, two of the three London Bridge attackers were known to the authorities. One in particular, Khurram Butt, had even appeared in that TV documentary I mentioned. And members of the British public had also called the police about him. So how did he and his accomplices manage to slip through? I asked Shashank Joshi for his take. He's a fellow at the Royal United Services Institute in London.
Well, I think the key is to understand that being known to the authorities is a sort of is a meaningless category. If you look at the number of people known to MI5, which is our domestic intelligence service, it ranges to about 23,000 people who used to be subjects of interest. And then there are 3,000 people who are current subjects of interest. And then an even smaller number than that, maybe 500 or so, who are subject to active investigation. Now, the people who conducted both the Manchester attack and indeed the London attack were once subjects of interest. So they were once investigated, they were surveilled, they were looked at in some detail. But if nothing was found, if there were no indications of active plotting, given the fact that you have 3,000 other people who were subjects of interest, you have to downgrade some of these people. And so they went into the category of this big 23,000 strong pool of former subjects of interest. It is impossible for our intelligence service, or indeed any European intelligence service, to monitor that number of people, given the competing threats they face. It's a question of raw numbers and resources.
Well, how do you become a subject of interest in the first place?
Well, they don't tell us exactly how, and of course that makes sense, given that if they did, people would find ways to avoid it. But it could be anything from communicating with a known terrorism suspect. Maybe you're trying to obtain ingredients for an explosive device or trying to acquire weapons. Maybe you've made comments about a plot in a local circle or to local networks or colleagues, and you've been reported. So any number of things could do that. But this is not a new problem. If you go back almost 10 years to the 7/7 bombings, the London bombings of 2005, we find that, again, the bombers were either not known to the authorities at all, or they were only known in a very rough level. They were known as sort of individuals, but their names were not identified. And again, the resources were not there to prioritize them when there were other competing issues. So the challenge, in other words, is sifting through the number of people in that big pool to say which ones matter and which ones don't. And I would say that we have a slightly skewed perspective of this because, of course, we pick up on the cases where these attacks occur. And, of course, they're likely to be the cases where people have slipped through the net. But we sometimes fail to recognize the UK authorities have also stopped over a dozen plots in the past few years. And, of course, that's not a terribly bad success rate for any country facing the kind of challenges that the UK does.
In the case of what happened in London on Saturday night, one of the attackers, this man, Khurram Butt, two people say they separately contacted the authorities about his extremist behavior, and he even appeared in this British documentary about extremists. So is the system that's in place, does it just not work, or is this really just a matter of resources?
It's a question of understanding the size of the haystack before saying, why didn't they spot the needle? In this case, the UK's anti-terror hotline in the year to March, so, you know, just in the year before this spring, received about 20,000 calls. So you can imagine one or two calls that may have been serious may have been disregarded or de-emphasized. The UK's PREVENT program, which is our principal counter-radicalization program, has received thousands and thousands of referrals over the years in which it's been in operation. So once again, the issue really is not how did they miss this, but should they have missed it, given what they knew at the time, relative to all of the thousands of other tips and tip-offs and cases that were pouring in.
But surely you're not saying that the security services of the UK will never be able to stamp out this problem.
Well, I don't think it's a question of never, but I would say that it's a generational issue. And indeed, the director general of MI5 has called it exactly that, a generational problem. That is, not months, not years, not even decades, possibly much longer than that. And one of the reasons for that is, of course, we have one of the highest numbers of people who've gone to fight in Syria and Iraq. We face a huge problem of nearly, 400, 500 people who've come back. We can't lock them all up. We can't prosecute all of them because that would violate secret intelligence. And so these guys are, in their 20s or even younger than that in some cases. They will be around for a long, long time, and they will present a really formidable threat to the police and intelligence agencies.
Shashank Joshi, a fellow at the Royal United Services Institute in London, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
If you're scrolling through Facebook during a terror attack, you might get notifications that friends in the area have checked in that they're safe. When Facebook first launched the safety check-in feature in 2014, it was presented as a tool for identification during natural disasters. But it was used during the 2015 terrorist attack in Paris, and Facebook has activated it dozens of times since, following bombings and shootings around the globe. Some say the feature gives them a sense of relief, but Aaron Balick says it gives people an overinflated sense of danger and panic. And he should know, Aaron is the author of the book, The Psychodynamics of Social Networking. So why did you decide not to use Facebook safety check feature during the attack in London over the weekend, which is where you live?
I mean, it's kind of a paradox, Marco, because on the surface, you would think, absolutely, that's something that I would do. And for me, it was quite personal. I started to get the notifications from friends who were checking themselves in a safe. And every time I would get that notification, I would get this demand from Facebook saying, check in and let everybody know you're safe. And I just started to feel really uncomfortable with this demand. And the more and more of my friends started checking in safe in a very strange way, the less I wanted to participate.
What made you feel uncomfortable?
Well, I stopped to think it through. And I think it was the assumption that I wasn't safe until I let everybody know that I was. And I think there's something pernicious and unsettling about that.
So is your beef with Facebook, or is it with the public that maybe kind of has a hair trigger when it comes to using safety check?
So it's not just Facebook. It's not just social media. It's also the way in which we all engage in our basic mobile phone use. Any of us, and I include myself in this, who finds that they've left the house without their mobile phone often experiences this moment of panic.
And that, okay, I'm laughing because so I felt it this morning.
Yes, exactly. And, what a psychotherapist does is wonder what the motivation for the panic is. And I think the secondary thought is, what if there's an emergency? What if I can't get in touch with someone? What if they can't get in touch with me? And that means that there's this baseline assumption that we're all in danger all the time. And I think that brings down a kind of quality of life.
Is there an accelerator dynamic here? Does the safety check feature, in your opinion, actually increase anxiety in situations like what happened in London?
I would say this with the proviso that I think most people disagree with me on this. I'm not criticizing people's desire to assure each other. But I do think for an isolated incident like what happened in London on Saturday night, it elevates it to a global threat. If there were an earthquake, if there were a huge event, Paris, for example, which was widespread, I think it serves a purpose.
Going to the next stepping stone here, I mean, terrorists do thrive on sowing panic. Maybe, safety check is the kind of reaction that perpetrators of these kinds of attacks are looking for.
This is really the basis of the more sociocultural concern of mine, because what happens is it becomes an own goal, doesn't it? We got Facebook safety check on. That kind of sets a bar. If you can do that now, then you've really caused a panic. And, you look at the breadth of the safety check. There were people 100 miles away who were being asked to check in. So I do think it does serve a distortion mechanism. I think the intention was probably a positive one, but I think the way in which it's rolled out very possibly does more harm than good, at least in some of these isolated occasions in which it's been used.
Aaron Balick, the author of the book, The Psychodynamics of Social Networking. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
What the diplomatic fight over Qatar means if you're living in Qatar, that's coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We all know about metadata. The things we post and send on the net contain lots of data that you can't see. Where you posted it, what time, all that stuff, and more. But even in the analog world, like on that paper memo lying on your desk, there's hidden data. It's this kind of old-school analog metadata that appears to have helped authorities figure out who leaked a highly classified National Security Agency report. The document was published by the news website The Intercept. It describes Russian hacking efforts just days before the U.S. presidential election last year. And right after The Intercept published, the Justice Department announced its charges against the alleged leaker, an NSA contractor named Reality Lee Winner. For more on how this happened, we turn to Joseph Cox. He's a reporter for the Vice tech website Motherboard.
So The Intercept get this physical document, old school, in the mail. And then as part of their reporting, The Intercept goes to the NSA and sends them a scan of the document, presumably to get comment or a response. The NSA then notices that there's a fold or a crease in this document, which tips them off that it was physically printed at some point. And then that kind of snowballs from there. They simply go and check who printed this document around this time frame. There's around six people, and then they narrow it down to this Reality Winner.
Now, Reality Winner also made some contact with The Intercept using her work computer, correct?
Yeah, so that's basically how the investigators, when they had these six people that had printed the document, they found, just through an audit of the suspect's work computers, that she had contacted The Intercept via her work computer a few months prior. It wasn't anything to do with leaking. She was actually asking for a transcript of The Intercept's podcast. But, of course, that is enough to create reasonable suspicion that, hey, the person who printed this document also reads The Intercept. So investigators carried on from there.
Hard to know what The Intercept was thinking, but do you think they realized that there is metadata in analog paper documents?
I mean, The Intercept is a phenomenal publication, and they have some of the best security and digital security experts in the world. I mean, you could arguably say that if the NSA is auditing every single file that employees or contractors are looking at, they would have found their suspect irrespective of what The Intercept did. Of course, that's a what-if scenario,
right. But
I'm a little surprised by the apparent and alleged way that Winner went about this. Of course, Edward Snowden took various technical measures, apparently, to cover up his track. But even when you may not have that sort of background, you're working for the NSA, and this does seem like a fairly sloppy way to leak, especially top-secret material.
Well, Edward Snowden certainly separated himself right out of the country. And when I think back to some of the high-profile leaks in recent years, obviously NSA contractor Snowden comes up. There was also Chelsea Manning, the Army private who was jailed for one of the largest leaks of classified documents in U.S. history, also just released from prison. Any trends that you're noticing, Joseph?
Yeah, this modern wave of whistleblowers are incredibly young, whereas we used to have Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers and et cetera.
Is it techno-literates meeting the idealism of youth that is doing this?
Yeah, I mean, it could be that these people are young and they get into their government job and they see wrongdoing. And maybe if you were a bit older, and maybe you wouldn't want to do it. But that is not to be patronizing or condescending at all. I mean, if you're going to make the decision to leak a top secret document or a cache of large top secret documents, you're going to give yourself a pretty good reason to do it.
Joseph Cox is a reporter for the Vice tech website Motherboard. Moving now over to the Middle East, Qatar is kind of a pariah in its neighborhood right now. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Bahrain, and Yemen have all cut diplomatic ties to Qatar. They accuse Qatar of supporting terrorism in the region. Donald Trump seems to think so, too. Qatar is flat out denying it, but people there are worried. Most international flights in and out of Qatar have been suspended. Saudi Arabia has closed its land border, and that could threaten food shipments into Qatar. It's all a bit unnerving to Alex Johnson, who used to be in our newsroom. Alex is now a schoolteacher living and working in Doha, the capital of Qatar.
There's a lot of rumors. There's mystery about what's going to come next. It comes at an interesting time because most of the teachers who work at our school will leave the country in, probably a week and a half to 2 weeks. Mm. So if you're flying from Qatar to another country in the GCC, then your plans just changed in a big way.
So is that going to be a problem for you when the school year ends next week?
I don't think so, but things could change. So we have flights booked out directly from Qatar to Europe on Qatar Airways. And so that shouldn't be an issue, or at least it's not an issue so far. But I have a few colleagues who were laying over in Abu Dhabi and Dubai. And so those flights were canceled. And so they're being forced to rebook on other airlines. It's not like you can't get out of the country right now. It's just that the plans that you originally had, those are going to change.
Right. So how are you experiencing personally these headlines of an isolated Qatar, Alex?
People started talking about it at school yesterday, and it reminded me of when we first moved here. I think it was 2013 when there was a bit of a rift between Qatar and other Gulf countries over Qatar's support of the Muslim Brotherhood, if I remember correctly, and ambassadors were withdrawn. It blew over a short time after that, and so nothing really came of it. And so that was my expectation of what was coming down the pike today. So then people started talking about, well, maybe you should go to the grocery store because the land border is closed. And that's something that had not happened in my experience here before.
The border with Saudi Arabia, correct?
And the only border out of the country, yeah.
Right.
And so my wife and daughter and I went to the grocery store, and I don't want to make it sound like all the shelves were empty, because that's not the case. But anything that you would get from Saudi Arabia that's perishable, like milk or fresh chicken, eggs, all that sort of stuff was totally gone.
So with a child, that's kind of worrying, but I suppose you can always leave the country if the hardship got too much. What about Qataris? How worrying is this for them?
The only sense that I've gotten from what I've read in the news and what I've seen on Twitter is that Qataris they have tremendous national pride. And so I think in a situation like this, the instinct would be to support the country and whatever the ruling family thinks is the right thing to do. I think we're at a stage right now where you can get on a plane and fly out on a certain airline and on a certain route to certain places. But if that changed, if it were impossible to get out, then that would be a completely different story. And so right now I don't feel nervous. I don't feel uncomfortable because we have a plane ticket out of here.
Saudi Arabia does provide nearly half of Qatar's food. And I know you've driven over to the Qatar-Saudi border before. And even on a good day, I hear it's chaotic. What can you imagine happening with these economic ties being severed with Qatar?
I've driven through Saudi Arabia twice, once to drive to the United Arab Emirates and once to Bahrain and back. And in terms of food shipments going across the border, there's just like both times I went, we must have passed hundreds of trucks lined up with their engines off, just waiting. I don't know what they're waiting for, but I could imagine in a situation like this, if you were driving your truck on the way to the border and you didn't know that the border was closed, then you end up at the border and there's probably many, many other people in that exact same situation. And so I can imagine long, long lines of trucks.
American school teacher Alex Johnson, currently living and working in Doha, Qatar. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the story of a young Indian girl who was sold into the sex trade by her own family.
And one night, while my mother and aunt stood outside the door, this person came to my room. I begged this person to let me go, but he had paid.
She eventually found a way out. Her story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In India, there's an unofficial statistic. Every 8 minutes, a girl goes missing. Most of these girls are trafficked into the sex trade, begging, or domestic labor. Many are lured into slavery by people they trust, members of their own family sometimes. The stories, no surprise, are heartbreaking. Once in a while, there are the girls who break out of the cycle, who escape. But what do you do when your trafficker is a member of your family? And what if you can't go home? For our Across Women's Lives project, Chavi Sachdev has this story from Mumbai.
I'm going to introduce you to an extraordinary 16-year-old. I'm meeting her at a shelter home for girls who've been rescued from trafficking. To protect her identity and her family, we're going to call her Panshi, a name that means bird. It's what she chooses to call herself.
Panshi.
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 She grew up about an hour outside Mumbai with her mother, younger sister, and younger brother. Her mother worked, and so did an older sister who's married. Panshi loved school, though she had few friends. She did really well in her classes. But then at 13, her family made her drop out because they couldn't afford it anymore.
And when I was against family,
She tells me she really fought her family on this. But then while she dropped out, she met an 18-year-old boy, a friend. He supported her ideas. He even met her parents and tried to persuade them to let her study, told them he'd marry her. She's not sure why they didn't like him, but they were separated. She was packed off to her father's village in a different state. She doesn't know where she was sent, but she knew she was miserable. She wanted to go back to school, and she wanted to go back to her friend. Eventually, her aunt said that the only way they'd let her return to the city was if she joined the family trade.
At that time, I wanted to return so badly, I pretended to agree to my aunt's condition. I said I'd do whatever they wanted.
But that family trade, what the women in her tribe, the Bedias, traditionally do, is prostitution. The men in the families pimp their wives and sisters. The women earn the money. In Mumbai, Panchi's mother and her aunts are sex workers. Her older sister is a dancer who performs at dance bars, India's version of strip clubs, but without nudity. So they brought her back to the city, but things move much more quickly than she expected.
I thought we were going to my sister's house, but ended up at my aunt's. And one night, while my mother and aunt stood outside the door, this person came to my room. I begged this person to let me go meet my friend. But he had paid. What do I say? He didn't want to waste it. The money mostly went to my aunt's. Some went to my mother.
It was her initiation into the sex trade. She screamed and she cried, all the time knowing her mother was right outside listening, but no one helped. She describes a horrendous 10 days of being sold to clients, begging her aunts and mother to let her go. At one point, it seemed like her mother would relent, but her aunt stalked her out of it. Her older sister finally came and took her away from the aunt after she fell violently sick. Back at their home, Panchi was now reluctant to get in touch with her friend. She was afraid he'd reject her because of what had happened to her. But he didn't.
He cried a lot and then said, I fell in love with you, not your body. I don't care what's happened to you. And then he said, come with me.
Panchi had found a solution, but it wasn't legal. She ran away with him, and for nearly a year, they lived under the radar as a couple, just the two of them. He worked, she ran the house, they saved money, and she talks of it being the happiest time in her life. Then his father fell sick and his family asked them to move back to Mumbai. But doing that would have gotten them both arrested. Her family had registered a police complaint against the boy for kidnapping. So 15-year-old Panchi went to the police herself to let them know that she hadn't been kidnapped, but had rescued herself out of prostitution.
I went to the police station and told them my family did this to me, and that's why I'm with him and want to stay with him. It was a big mistake, actually.
It all went sideways because she's a minor. Local officials wouldn't let her stay with the friend, and sending her back to her family was risky. There was a high probability she'd end back in the sex trade. So, on the 7th of September 2015, she was sent to the Nonihal home in Mumbai, where I met her earlier this year. The shelter home for girls who have been trafficked. Nonihal means sapling in Hindi. Panchi's first 2 months at Nonihal were so hard, she told me, she cried all the time. But now she has reinvented herself yet again and is very much on track.
Being here, I've gained a lot of skills. I want to study. I want to graduate.
At the shelter, social workers, counselors and staff give the girls the freedom to figure out who they are within guidelines and structure. The girls go to school, they get vocational training so they can transition to being self-reliant, independent women when they come of age at 18. It's a special place with an excellent track record. None of the girls who have lived in the shelter have gone back to the sex trade. But even here, Panchi is unusual. Preeti Patkar is one of the founders of the shelter, and since 1986, she's worked with thousands of trafficked girls.
She's strong, self-driven, diligent, focused, knows exactly what she wants. And she's a child who doesn't live in the past, who wants to work on her present so that her future looks like what she wants it to look like.
She's unusual, I think, in every respect, even compared with girls who've never been assaulted.
Yes, yes. She is unusual. She is. She, definitely.
Banshi is now attending school after a break of 3 years. At the home, she's learned to make beautiful jewelry, which she sells. The money she earns goes into a bank account she can't access until she's 18. But she laughs and says even when she's 18, she won't touch it. She'll get a part-time job and continue to put money away. Her family visits frequently and begs her to come back home, but she doesn't go because she wants to keep on studying. Banshi dreams of becoming a social worker and changing the lives of kids from her tribe and looking after her mother in her old age.
So, where I go to Sanpada, there is a building that I really like. There's
an apartment building I pass in the evenings with a lovely garden. There are old ladies sitting there. I picture my mother sitting there.
This year, Panshi's plan is to learn English. She's saving money and she's singing.
Babul pyare sachne sikhare sun lo meri maiya.
How can money sell me? The chorus goes. How can money sell me?
Mere liye main khud hi sahi.
For me, I'm enough. I have to rely on myself.
For the world, Chavi Sachdev, Mumbai.
So Chavi's story highlights a problem in India, the country with the highest rate of human trafficking in the world. But remember that trafficking isn't just a problem that happens someplace else. It happens every day right here in the U.S. Leila Milani is with the anti-trafficking organization Futures Without Violence. She joins us from Washington. So some perspective here, Leila. How large is the U.S. human trafficking problem? What are the numbers?
The problem is that we don't have an accurate account, but we do know that it takes place in every single state in the United States. It's both sex trafficking and labor trafficking. It's boys, it's girls, it's men, it's women. It's domestic victims, in other words, U.S. citizens, and international victims, individuals who are brought in.
So what communities in the U.S. are the most vulnerable?
Runaway and homeless youth. Kids who have experienced some kind of trauma in the home that take to the streets. And it's there that they find themselves to become the most vulnerable and fall prey to the hands of the traffickers. And to a large extent, what can also happen to find security themselves, the very victims end up sometimes helping the perpetrators just to give themselves a break, just to reduce the pressure on them. So in other words, if they go find another runaway youth, they can replace them for the night and give themselves a break. So that's kind of the cycle of trafficking.
Leila, would you say then that the two main groups of people trafficked in the U.S. are minors, as you say, and also foreigners who are brought here?
Yes. Either they're brought here or they have come here voluntarily, but once they enter here, they're trafficked.
So, Leila, what can our listeners do? Like, is there a role for all of us to play in this problem?
Absolutely. First, we can make donations to organizations that identify themselves as anti-trafficking organizations or even organizations that provide services to youth, children, and susceptible populations. Number two, we can also lend our own services. Whatever talents and skills we have as individuals can be offered to these organizations. There can be after-school mentoring for youth and children. There can be coaching programs. There can be social service type programs. If you have expertise in trauma, you can lend your support.
Filling in some of the gaps where those kids are finding themselves without parents for several hours in a row.
Absolutely. There's a significant role we can play if we're just there for 1 or 2 hours in the afternoons where we can lend after school services to some of these children and youth, like tutoring. It seems very simple, and at times you wonder, how can my tutoring math to a 13-year-old make a difference in them not becoming trafficked? It actually, those hours spent where the individual, one, is learning a skill, but two, is connecting with someone who is expressing to them their value, that connection is incredible, and it can be very impactful.
Well, Leila, thanks so much for filling us in on the American side of the trafficking problem. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Leila Milani is with the anti-trafficking organization Futures Without Violence. If you have questions about trafficking here in the U.S. or a story about trafficking happening in your community, we're hosting a Facebook Live with Leila. Just go to our Across Women's Lives Facebook page and leave your questions and comments for her. Then tune in tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern for the live event. May and June are dragon boat season in Hong Kong. There's a festival and a carnival and all kinds of races held in the city's harbor. Friend of the show and food writer Steve Dolinsky went to Hong Kong recently to take it all in.
It was a brilliantly hot and sunny day here in Hong Kong today. Dragon boat race is taking place all over the city, and I managed to catch one of them in action. But of course, the thing that I was interested in was what people were eating, and it is this little dumpling. It's almost like a Chinese tamale. Rice wrapped inside of banana leaves. And I wanted to really get the story from one of my colleagues here from the South China Morning Post. Susan Zhang's the food editor, and we talked about this tradition that is taking place all over Hong Kong right now. So the Dragon Boat Festival that's been going on, I know there's this ancient tradition. People threw rice into the water so that the fish would eat the rice and not this beloved man.
This general or minister in China a long time ago was accused of treason, so he committed suicide by drowning. So he was so beloved by the people that they threw rice dumplings into the water so that the fish would eat the rice dumplings rather than him.
So many millennia later, I see these rice dumplings everywhere in every corner. What are they called and what's in them?
They're zhong or zhongzi. They're rice primarily, wrapped in banana leaves. They can be sweet or savory, but they're really, really delicious. A lot of the Cantonese ones have salted egg, pork, little beans, lotus seeds.
They're filling, by the way. They are not like a little light snack. That glutinous rice is pretty sticky and heavy.
Yes. They're very, very filling. And you steam them, and you can eat them with a little soy sauce or a little bit of sugar, depending on whether they're savory or sweet. And it's just a custom to eat them at this time of year.
And of course, I couldn't wait very much longer to try one of these zhongzi. I just walked over to the nearest vendor here in the central district of Hong Kong and found someone with a lot of zhongzi. Just bought one for the equivalent of about $1.50. Just unwrapping it from the bamboo leaf. You can see it's a lot of glutinous rice, actually. I can get inside the middle of it. There's a salted egg yolk in there. And there's a little bit of pork belly, it looks like. Just a little bit of, that could be mung bean or lotus bean. The ratio of rice to filling, it's got to be at least 4 to 1. So there's no crispiness to it. It's not something I could have every day. I could see it's more of a ceremonial thing, like having a mooncake in the fall. The zhongzi is something, I mean, it really, the best way to describe it is like a Chinese tamale. This is something that everyone's eating all over Hong Kong right now. For the world, I'm Steve Dolinsky in Hong Kong.
I want to take a minute now to tell you about a story we're working on. It's about some religious women in Salt Lake City who've been protesting at the local Office of Homeland Security. They say deportation is breaking up local immigrant families, and that violates their core values.
We ourselves were refugees. So that's an issue that, regardless of political persuasion, touches our hearts.
The group has attracted thousands of members. Many of them voted Republican in the last election, but they may be losing faith with the Trump administration.
Yeah, I've kind of been switching. I was more Republican, and then I've definitely moved towards the Democratic side because I just feel like we need to be for common sense. What has been happening, this isn't common sense.
Rallying Mormons to stop deportations, that's coming up tomorrow here on the show. President Trump seems to be doing his best to shake up the world order he inherited from his predecessors. He's questioned the value of established alliances and pulled back from international agreements. Trump's actions have also given a boost to a global trend toward nationalism and populism. That worries Susan Rice, former national security advisor to President Obama. But she says the model of Western democracy hasn't entirely collapsed, at least not yet.
I think it's too soon to declare the death of Western values and Western democracy by any stretch. But the fact that these fissures exist and there is fragility internally within a number of countries underscores the importance of the Western countries hanging together. And what is so damaging about what we have witnessed with President Trump's leadership and his refusal to affirm our commitment to our NATO allies, his denigration of the European Union, is that it exacerbates these fissures and weakens unity among Western nations, all to the benefit of Russia, whose greatest fantasy is that the West collapse.
Let me just get back to these fissures and these divides, because populism happens on both sides of the aisle. I mean, Democrats championed free trade, which left a lot of people in middle America stranded in poverty, right?
Well, I never suggested that populism was a partisan phenomenon, but the point remains that even as we work to address the legitimate concerns that drive that populism, we need to be careful not to whip up the kind of nationalism or xenophobia that exacerbates internal division. It's one thing to deal with economic inequality and the dislocations of globalization in a more effective way, which I believe we must. It's quite another thing to divide ourselves internally and to exacerbate through nationalist rhetoric or even hate speech the kinds of divisions that have been so crippling to us and to others over the decades.
Ambassador Rice, do you ever worry that the moral component of American leadership has been overstated?
Well, I think we need to be careful as we lead in the world to do so with some degree of humility and recognition that our experience is imperfect. But what has made us great is that despite our imperfections, we have sought to continuously perfect ourselves. At least that's been the long arc of our national history, whether it relates to the inclusion of women or the civil rights movement or more recently opening up of a greater opportunity for equality for our LGBT citizens. Mm. You know, what is worrying is efforts to undermine that national unity and to jettison our defense of the fundamental values that are core to our nation and, frankly, universal values, things like freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion. All of the democratic values that we hold dear are crucial to our leadership and our standing in the world. And one of the things that I think we are at risk of losing is our global moral leadership by virtue of the fact that President Trump and Secretary of State Tillerson and others have made very clear now that our values are to be subordinated to our interests. In my mind, that's a false dichotomy. Our interests and our values are mutually reinforcing. But what they have said is to Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or Egypt or others that we no longer care how you treat your citizens. You can shoot them in the streets, which is what we have seen in Bahrain in the wake of President Trump's statement to the Arab world in Saudi Arabia that we really don't want to uphold our values or insist that they are of importance universally. So that I worry about.
If I could ask you just a quick last question, how are you coping reading these headlines every day? Is there kind of a surreal element to all of this for you?
Marco, I don't know that my experience is much different from most other Americans. I read the headlines with interest, and I, as a national security professional for over 25 years, worry that we are at risk of losing our global leadership to the detriment of our security and to the detriment of the rest of the world. My hope is that while we go through this period of what seems to be a calculated disengagement from our global leadership by this administration, that Congress, the American people as individuals, as civil society, as American business, will step up and fill the void and make it clear to the rest of the world that we have every intention of remaining a global leader, that we have every intention of upholding our values, and that what we are experiencing now is an aberration rather than a new normal.
Ambassador Rice, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco. I appreciate it.
Ambassador Rice didn't mention music as a coping mechanism, a way to connect with people you don't totally understand, but it certainly worked for a certain Iranian-Canadian duo when they drop into small towns like Whitefish, Montana. This is Niaz. After their shows, it's not uncommon for people to tell the band how much their music helped them understand the beauty of Islam. That's what lead singer Azam Ali told me.
One of the things that NIAZ, we do with NIAZ is we do a lot of outreach programs. So we do a lot of performing arts series, and then we also do outreach programs with high school students, young kids. It actually has become much more important for us, and we have been received so warmly, and we have these discussions either before the concert or after where the community is invited, and even if they are afraid, they're willing to talk about it and they are willing to sort of reach out. There's such a strong social message in what we do, and we always mention that during our concerts. Really, it is about building bridges, and music, and I mean art in general, is the place you come to elevate the soul, and you leave behind all the boundaries that separate us, cultural, religious, and on this bridge, it's a human bridge, and we are connected. You know, it's really about humanity, and that's what we try to promote. And there's no better art form that is able to bring people together than music. And my greatest moments of pride are when I'm standing on a stage and I look out and I see people from all backgrounds out there. I feel there's nothing more that I could have done to succeed in this life than to bring people together, and I'm very proud of that.
Azam Ali of NIAZ. Always great to hear new music from them. On the new Best Of CD from NIAZ, they include some previously unreleased material. This song, in fact, which we'll leave you with today, it's called Del, a love song from 1950s Iran. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.